around the world, and thank you for joining us once again on truth2u.org. That's truth2u.org. I'm Jono, and joining me in the virtual Truth to You studio all the way from Ireland is Jason of spiritualbabies.net. G'day, mate.
Good morning. Good morning.
And in Jakarta, Indonesia, is the author of the recently released Let's Get Biblical, Why Doesn't Judaism Accept the Christian Messiah, Volumes 1 and 2. You can get a copy from his website at outreachjudaism.org. That's outreachjudaism.org. Welcome back to the program, Rabbi Tobias Singer.
Good day, mate.
Good day, mate. See, a little bit of practice makes all the difference, doesn't it?
I think that would have gone over. I think I could have swung that over. I think that was pretty close.
That was pretty close. This, yeah. See, practice makes perfect. Season 2 of Torah Pearls. And where are we? We're in Miketz. That's where we are, right?
Yeah, we're in Miketz and we're in Hanukkah time.
And actually, before we even get onto that topic, comments. Susan said, love it, just like always. I can't believe all the great teachings and knowledge that the Jewish people have had all these years. So glad to be able to hear it now. Better late than never. I agree, Susan. And Julie said, excellent as usual. And Rita, another A+ episode. Thanks, guys, for feedback on the last program. William said, love the show, Jono. Awesome insight from the rabbi that I'd never seen before. And he said, Jason, by the way, cool book.
Oh, I'm glad he enjoyed it. He probably enjoyed it a few times.
I bet he's read it a few times since last week. That was Paul Quoting Jesus, a book that you can find on Amazon from Jason's Spiritual Babies. And that's right, Hanukkah. Go on, give us a quick Hanukkah spiel, Tobia.
Well, Hanukkah is not an accident that the festival of Hanukkah, which is one of the most popular festivals on the Jewish calendar, comes out precisely when we're reading these portions of Joseph and his brothers. Hanukkah is that festival that has no book. Every other festival that we have has a book. You can go to the book. If you want to read it, know about what happened to Purim, you can open up a book in the Bible, and that's the book of Esther. If you want to learn about the three major holidays, the Moadim, Passover, Sukkot, Shavuot, Sukkot, you certainly can open up the Bible. Hanukkah remains the only holiday that is of rabbinic origin. It's after the closing of the canon of Tanakh, and we don't have a book for it. Now, it's true that there are histories that are written about Hanukkah, most famous.
The Maccabees, right?
The Book of Maccabees, but that's not divinely inspired. It's not a holy book. It's very valuable. It's very valuable to us, but it is not, it's not the word of Hashem. It's not the word of God. So we're left with that. We have, of course, the Talmud. We have extensive information. We have Josephus. We have, but we don't, it seems that we don't have a book. One of the other points about Hanukkah is that when we read the literature of that we express on Hanukkah, a very important part of history of what sparked this war against the Greek Empire, against Syria, against Antiochus Epiphanes, is sort of left out. And that's also the case when the Jews go to war against Rome in 66. Mm-hmm. What most people are not aware of is how did the Maccabees come to go to war against Antiochus Epiphanes. Antiochus Epiphanes, after the death of Alexander the Great, the empire is divided into four parts, and Antiochus Epiphanes seeks to destroy Torah, brings idolatry and poor pigs into the temple and so on. And the way we generally know the story is that the Maccabees rose up and went to war against them. But that is not, in fact, historically accurate, or it's missing a very important feature. That feature is that initially the Jews, the Maccabees, did not go to war against Antiochus Epiphanes, but rather they went to, it began with a civil war, meaning that in the Greek Empire, which brought with it, there was a survey done of scholars, of historians, a number of years ago, and they asked, the question was posed, who was the most important personality, the most important individual that affected Western civilization? Overwhelmingly, the answer was Alexander the Great. when he, in his relatively short life, would conquer basically the whole known world. He would spread Greek thought, philosophy, and so on throughout. That influence would be astounding. And what happened is that there were Jews who began to adopt the ways of the Greeks, who began to assimilate and became close with the Greek Empire, with the Syrian Greek Empire, with the Seleucid Empire. And it was the Maccabees who went to war with them, with these Jews. Now, these Jews
They were willing to compromise, right?
Yeah, they're willing to compromise. So you had assimilated Jews who, like today, we see today, who are the ones who are supporting, all kinds of things that are not Israel, and that was the war, began among the Jews. And obviously these Jews who were very assimilated were very worried, and they then called in Antiochus Epiphanes to defend them, to protect them. And after all, they were the ones who were the, like the Sadducees and their relationship with Rome, they were the Jews who were, had the great import. They were the Jews who would collect taxes on behalf of the Greek, of the Seleucid government, and so on. And then the Maccabees went to war, and that, when the Greeks came in, they were very harsh, and they came in and they wanted to destroy Torah, and it was forbidden to circumcise your sons, it was forbidden to study Torah, and then all hell breaks loose, and then heaven breaks loose, and the Maccabees are successful. But this civil war element seems to be missing from our literature. If you read the prayers that we say on Hanukkah, it isn't there. You won't find it. You will find it in the works of history. It's very clear. It's an identical event occurs in 66. It is a mistake to believe that the Jews went to war with Rome. They just went to war. That didn't happen. What happened was the Jews were very divided. You had the Sadducees who were in cahoots with Rome, and it was the Jews who were against the taxation, against the influence of Rome. They went to war as civil war against their brothers. And that would ultimately bring these element, this elite element. They were the ones who controlled the temple. They controlled the money. When Rome wanted to collect money, they didn't send Romans. They sent these Jews who were close to the temple. That's where the money was kept, in the temple. To this day, the architecture of a bank is that of a temple. There's a reason for that, because in the ancient world, when you wanted to keep money somewhere that people were unlikely to break into, they kept it in the temple. That's where it was kept. So you can imagine, when the Jews who were in cahoots with Rome, it's the civil war that ultimately sparks the Rome. They call in Rome, and then the war breaks out in Rome. So it's very critical what's coming before us. The reason why Hanukkah is time to these portions of Torah that we are now going through is we are seeing what happens when a family is broken, when when brothers go to war with each other. It isn't an accident, incidentally, that there are two miracles associated with Hanukkah. One is the miracle of the military victory over the Greeks. That's very well known. And then there's this, what seems to be a very minor miracle, and that is that there was only one flask of oil that was sufficient for one day for the menorah, and it went on for 8 days. And that seems to be the miracle that's permeated and most widely known, not so much the military victory. The question is why? So this is an important point. So first, what we're seeing is in some ways, these passages here, when we're dealing with this, a war between brothers, Joseph and his brothers, and the consequences of that civil war, we are to know that Hanukkah was launched by essentially brother against brother. That's how it was launched. The military victory of the Maccabees, as it turns out, was only a momentary blink of success. The Maccabees, although they won the war, eventually would still be a vassal state just in Judea. Ultimately, the Romans would come in. It was very short-lived. The Maccabee family was wiped out by Herod. But it was that blink of the light of the menorah, that wink from God, that light of the menorah, that's what permeated, that God was saying, I am there with you, even in the darkness, even in this time of the year, during the winter, when we don't have a Jewish holiday. And it's during that blink of darkness that God says, I'm with you, I see you, I'm there. And it's that remains with us. The success, the military success of the Maccabees did not remain. It very quickly evaporated, it receded. But this miracle, the miracle that God said, I'm with you, even in the middle of the winter, when darkness prevails, when the owl is strong rather than the rooster, when we don't have Jewish holidays, God is saying, I'm there. The lighting of the menorah is there with you. And we can, in fact, see this in the Bible, an allusion to Hanukkah. And it obviously goes through the entire year, beginning with Passover, that's the first month, and just continues through Shavuot, festival then Sukkot, the festival of tabernacles. And if you turn to, Leviticus 23.
Leviticus 23.
Yeah. Yeah. So here we have before us all the festivals that are right there, one after the other. And of course, Hanukkah would not be there because Hanukkah hadn't happened yet. It couldn't possibly be there. So you'll see that basically this passage ends. This entire chapter ends at the end of chapter 23 with Sukkot. At verse 44. But there's something very intriguing here. If we don't stop, but we keep going, remember it ends at Sukkot, that's the last holiday, that would have been the last holiday covered. But look at Leviticus chapter 24, verse 1, and particularly verse 2, 3, and 4.
It says, then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, command the children of Israel to bring you pure oil of pressed olives for the lights, to make the lamps burn continually. Outside the veil of the temple, in the tabernacle of meeting, Aaron will be in charge of it from evening until morning before the Lord continually. It shall be a statute forever in your generation. He shall be in charge of the lamps on the pure gold lampstand before the Lord continually.
So bang, there it is. That means what we have there, seemingly out of nowhere, is immediately following, look at verse 42, the previous chapter of Sukkot, that would end in the fall, bang. We're suddenly told about the tabernacle that you're to have the flame. And if you look carefully, there's an anomaly in this passage where if you look at the end of verse 2, lahalos ner tamid, that you should have a continual lamp that will continue. But if you look at verse 4, you'll see there it transitions al hamenorah. I don't have a translation in front of me. A hatorah on the pure menorah, yaruch es haneros. You have there the plural of the candles, of the many lights. And that transition, our sages see this as pointing to Hanukkah, that this is no matter where you are, no matter how dark it is, and this follows chronologically perfectly right after Sukkot, that God will wink at you. He's there and he sees you. But do understand, coming back to our case of Miketz, we're looking at Miketz and we bear in mind the tsuris, the aggravation, the misery, the difficulty and the challenges that our forefathers endured because of brotherly hatred. It could be that there could be many ways to deal with our brethren who are moving in the wrong direction. I could, if I wanted to, someone can go and blow up a Jews for Jesus building. God forbid, we would never do something like that. So should we go to war against Jews who have adopted Christianity? Or should we use a different approach, one that's longer lasting, and that is light the candle of the menorah. Those are the two approaches. And clearly, the way we celebrate Hanukkah is coming down on one of those sides. And that side is, don't do what Joseph and his brothers did. The military approach will have a momentary advantage, but in the long run, actually will recede. The way to influence your brothers, who you feel have betrayed their nation by converting, by abandoning the God of Israel, is not through violence. But rather it's by lighting the candle, becoming a lighthouse, a source of light, meaning Torah, for your brethren who have fallen on the other side. So Hanukkah very much is saying there are two strategies here, and the strategy to come down on is on the strategy of light, Torah. And that's what we're seeing playing out right here before our eyes.
That's what we're seeing, and it's the violence, obviously, that the brothers inflicted upon Joseph. They're right here in this Torah portion. It's all coming back to them now, and our Torah portion begins with Pharaoh's dreams. It says, then it came to pass at the end of two full years. Now, two full years, this is Joseph has been in jail all of this time. The last thing he said to the chief butler was, hey, put in a good word for me when you get out. Don't forget about me. Get me out of here because I haven't done anything wrong. But two full years went by, and then Pharaoh had a dream, and behold, he stood by the river, and suddenly there came out of the river seven cows, fine-looking and fat, and they fed in the meadow, and then behold, seven ugly cows came up. They were gaunt and ugly and stood by the other cows by the brink of the river, and the ugly cows, they ate up the fine-looking cows. And so Pharaoh awoke, and he slept again and dreamed a second time, and suddenly seven heads of grain came up on one stalk, plump and good, and behold, seven thin heads, blighted by the east wind, sprang up after them, and the seven thin heads devoured the seven plump full heads. So Pharaoh awoke, and indeed it was a dream, and it came to pass in the morning that his spirit was troubled. And he sent and called for all the magicians of Egypt and all the wise men, and Pharaoh told them his dreams, and there was no one who could interpret it for Pharaoh. And then the chief butler spoke to Pharaoh, saying, I remember my faults this day. When Pharaoh was angry with his servant, and you put me in jail, and he basically tells him the story, and he says, now, there was a young Hebrew man with us. He was a servant of the captain of the guard, and we told him our dreams, and he interpreted them. Interpreted the dreams for us, and what he said was going to happen indeed happened. And then Pharaoh sent and called Joseph and brought him quickly out of the dungeon. He shaved, he changed his clothes, and he came to Pharaoh. And Pharaoh said to Joseph, I've had a dream, and there is no one who can interpret it. But I have heard it said of you that you can understand a dream and interpret it. So Joseph answered Pharaoh, saying, it is not in me. God will give Pharaoh an answer of peace. Tobiah.
Yeah. So what's happening here is, I think that that every person who studied the Bible is thinking of another personality comes to mind who will now rise up to become great in exile. And one is Joseph. Joseph is about to interpret a dream that he's, and Pharaoh is going to recollect the dream, not precisely in the same way, but the show doesn't, is beyond the scope of the show to go through the variances and how Pharaoh repeats it. But the key is that we have Joseph is about to be told the dream, and then he's going to interpret it. And that interpreting a dream will then he will rise up to become essentially second in command of Egypt. Only Pharaoh is above him. Who else? What other Jew in history is going to be in exile? Is going to be able to interpret a dream, and he will essentially rise up to become second in power.
It's Daniel, right?
That's Daniel, right? Daniel is it is impossible. Daniel, in fact, is dealt a much more difficult interpretation job, because whereas Joseph was told the dream and he only had to interpret it, Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babel, was obviously very cognizant of what Joseph had, what happened with Joseph, and he says, I'm not going to even tell you the dream, you need to tell me. So Daniel was able to tell him the dream and what it meant, And we see the similarities are striking. What happens is he becomes second in command. He's given a new name, as we're going to see in a moment. Things change. So the similarities between the two is striking. But there's also a difference between them. The difference, I think, are even more striking in that Joseph was already a person who was a dreamer. He had dreamed earlier than this, and he was generating his own dream. But eventually, when he goes down to Egypt, he then essentially is working through somebody else's dream. And he's working through Pharaoh's dreams. He's now becoming somebody else's interpreter. Daniel is the exact opposite. This is the most striking part of the history. And that is, with Daniel doesn't have any history with dreams at all. And Daniel is the person who then is able to interpret this dream and able to interpret, not this dream, but a number of visions, tell them what it is, and then it is subsequent to that that Daniel, of course, rises up like Joseph, but then Daniel is able to then produce his own visions of the Messianic age, of the final redemption, of the future hope. It also isn't an accident that we have here essentially a struggle, as we discussed last week, and this is all going to come together for you, is the who is going to lead the family? Who is going to be the Bechor? Who's going to be the firstborn? And we have, of course, ultimately, this challenge is going to be between Joseph and Judah. And we see even in the Messianic passages, ultimately it's Joseph and Judah who are warring with each other in the civil war that splits the nation. But at the end of the days, they're going to come back together. But it's ultimately Judah who is the leader. Daniel somehow is rise. Daniel, of course, is from the house of David. He's from the tribe of Judah. Daniel rises up. And he then is able to produce a vision of the Messianic age, chapter 7, what we see is brilliant. So they're moving in different directions. Joseph is moving in direction from producing his own dream in the land of Israel. We talked about how the dream was very connected to Egypt. It was connected to the land. The two dreams were separated. One is on earth, one is in celestial, unlike Joseph's dream. Whereas Daniel is going to move to Trent to help Nebuchadnezzar understand his dream. So he's first working for somebody else, and then he's going to be able to actually produce his own vision for the future. Of course, it's through divine inspiration, which means he's going to rise up. He's going to rise up because his mind is going to be very focused on the land of Israel. He's going to fast for many years, or 21 years, to make sure that the Jewish people are going to return. Everybody ultimately gets it. We're not going here yet, but Joseph eventually is at the end of his life is going to realize the importance of the land of Israel, and he's ultimately going to plead, don't allow my bones to remain here in Egypt. Make sure you bring it back. It means everybody gets it at the end. So there is that resolution that happens, but this is Joseph's struggle. Very different than, obviously the similarities of what everyone notices of Daniel and Joseph, but it is most striking is the variances here, and then as they actually are each moving spiritually in an opposite direction. Daniel is moving toward the land of Israel, and therefore he's going to envision the Messianic age. It's Joseph who's actually working for Pharaoh and interpreting Pharaoh's dream, and that is what's fascinating, what's holding for us. And it is in fact Joseph and Judah who together look at the book of Avadah, who together will defeat Edom, the enemy of God. So everyone comes together.
So it's a very curious thing, dreams. I think it says, it might be in the book of Job, I think that one dreams out of the busyness of the day. But we see such emphasis, as you just pointed out, in dreams. And sometimes we dream and we can't remember the dream. We might have been, we know that it was, we were really into it when we were asleep, but it's gone, you know, seconds after we've woken up. Other times we dream and we can remember incredible detail because it was so vivid to us. But that doesn't mean, Toby, does it mean that each and every of our dreams has some sort of spiritual significance or some sort of message attached?
Not necessarily. You're right. If you go to Job chapter 20, you see over there that that a dream could be something that could fly away in a morphic way. For Daniel, it was a divine inspiration. The dream was attached to a vision that he saw that the angel was revealing to him, so it was very strong. For Joseph, when he was having dreams, he sensed that there was something very valuable here, because it was connected not to his own personal feelings, but he felt that he had what it took to lead the brothers, to lead the royal family in the proper spiritual direction. Remember, Reuben has failed, and he's going to fail again. We're going to see, even though Reuben is the firstborn son of Jacob, we've seen that Reuben has his heart in the right place. But one of the things the text is very points out again and again is he fails. He's not able to carry it forward. Everyone means well, we pointed out. Everyone is looking at this from a different perspective. Everyone means well, but the question is, who will emerge at the end of the book of Genesis? And we'll get to that in a few weeks from now. Who will emerge as the leader, the spiritual leader of this family? Will it be Reuben? Well, we'll see in a moment, very shortly, Reuben is going to be giving advice to his father. It's not going to be good advice, but he means well, but it's bad advice.
Get to that.
We'll get to
and,
that.
Judah also so, yeah, so, puts you his notice, hand up.
And that's the key, what you're looking for. We're looking for everyone means well. Everyone wants to lead the family in the right direction. And ultimately, one will emerge. One tribe will emerge as having what it takes to spiritually lead the family.
That's it. Jason, in the land of banshees and Guinness beer and leprechauns, you must have had some pretty wild dreams.
Every night we get wild dreams. We all do have dreams, and I'm sure that Pharaoh had a ton of weird dreams. But did he freak out after he woke up every morning? When we see Joseph have his original dream, that dream happened one time, but he had two dreams that portrayed kind of the same message. And and Pharaoh does the same. Pharaoh has two dreams that kind of have the same message, and that for him must have struck a chord and made him realize the significance of that, of what had happened, and that it was some sort of message. I mean, I don't know how many of us have maybe two or three nightmares in a night, but they're all kind of the same theme, but with different actors. I can't remember. Yeah, that's it. I can't remember that happening to me. I just want to bullet point some of the stuff very quickly.
Please.
In this period, and even up to today, there are winds in Arabia and the desert around the Middle East, which are terrifying to people. And the people of the land had different names for them. And I just wanted to point to a couple of things. So the east wind that's mentioned in verse 6 is traditionally known as the Sirocco wind. And that can decimate a harvest for 2 months. So when we read it, it's a really innocuous term. It just says east wind. Mm. But if you lived there, this particular wind, the east wind, was one that could wipe out a year's work. And I thought, it's worth mentioning. And when we read magicians for Pharaoh, they're actually scribes. So the Egyptian texts will say sacred scribes for those. So that's worth mentioning next time we go through. I mean, we imagine they come out with magic wands and loads of tricks in a bag. But I think it's more likely that they were as close to science as Egypt had at the time.
Right.
And that they they used that science to try and replicate with the miracles in nature.
Well, it's interesting just also that you mentioned the repetition of the dream, because it is verse 32. Joseph says to Pharaoh, and the dream was repeated to Pharaoh twice, because the thing is established by God and God will bring it to pass. And that's after he's already told him the interpretation of the dream, saying that you've had these two dreams, but the dreams are one. And what's going to happen is you're going to have 7 years of great plenty, and then you're going to have 7 years of famine, and everyone's going to forget about the plenty. So what you've got to do, and he gives Pharaoh the advice, is he says, select a discerning and wise man and set him over the land of Egypt. Let Pharaoh do this and let him appoint officers over the land to collect one-fifth of the produce of the land of Egypt in 7 plentiful years. Let them gather all the food of those good years that are coming and store up the grain under the authority of Pharaoh, and let them keep food in the cities. Then that food shall be as a reserve for the land in the years of famine, the 7 years of famine, which shall be in the land of Egypt, that the land may not perish during the famine. And so the advice was good in the eyes of Pharaoh and in the eyes of all his servants. And Pharaoh said to his servants, can we find such a one as this, a man in whom is the spirit of God. Tobiah, man in whom is the spirit of God.
Right. And now we have one of the greatest conundrums, questions in about the Torah, about what's happening here. And the greatest, one of the most difficult, puzzling issues to work out is at this moment, Joseph, we're obviously seeing that his dreams are being fulfilled. Everything now is being set up. He's now will be lifted up to be second in command. And in fact, his brothers are going to come and bow before him ultimately. His father will say his dreams are going to play out. But there's this fundamental question that everyone asks right here. Until this point, Joseph was in a prison. Joseph was a slave. Joseph did not have any authority over his life. But suddenly now, Joseph is now the second in command of Egypt. And the question is, his father. He knew that his father must have been miserable. He knew that his father loved him very much. Why at this stage, now that he is in command of Egypt, he's a vice president of Egypt, he's second in command, why at this juncture doesn't Joseph write to his father, send messengers to his father to let him know, I'm alive, I'm okay, I'm all right. Why does
That's
he?
That's a really good point. Yeah, I'd never thought of that before. Because now he's risen to power. He's got the signet ring. He's second in charge. He's got a chariot. Everyone cries out before him, bow the knee, and so on and so forth. Why at this point doesn't he go send out messengers to find his father?
Right. So this is a very big conundrum. I'll just share, and we're going to see now, you know, another interesting feature about Joseph, which is very striking, is we're going to see that he's going to be crying a lot. In fact, there's no one in the Torah, there's no one in Tanakh who cries as much as Joseph, which is also very striking. Why is there so much weeping, so much tears? And what we're going to do is right now is we're going to seek to answer this question. And when we do, whenever you have a correct answer, everything falls into place. The one answer should solve every single question. So the question is, why doesn't Joseph write back to his dad and say, I'm okay, send messengers, send a postcard, a fax, email, I'm fine, come here, I'll take care. Why does he remain silent? And in order to solve this question and to solve what is we're about to see before us, we have to apprehend something that is counterintuitive, and that is that we, when reading scripture, have access to information that none of the people who are in these events have access to. Jacob knows so much. We know much more than Jacob did at this time. Jacob thinks his son was killed by animals, right? So what we want to do is, in order to solve this question, is we have to actually detach ourselves from the text, because we're given the advantage of reading the Torah and seeing everything. It's all unfolding. We see all the different parts of the stage, so we assume that but we actually know what Joseph did not know. So in order to solve this question, we have to ask ourselves, what was Joseph thinking in that pit that he was thrown into? What was going through Joseph's mind? What did he know and what did he not know? Well, as it turns out, there was a lot he didn't know. Let's go back, and then we'll see where Joseph's mind is, and that will help us understand what's about to follow. Joseph had two dreams. The first dream only dealt with his brothers, and that was the dream that all the storks would bow to him. That was just involved with his brothers. His last conversation with his father was where he said, not only are my brothers going to bow to me, but in fact the sun and the moon. And the last thing that happened was something that was completely out of character. Until that moment, Joseph was Jacob's favorite. Joseph could do no wrong. Joseph had given him every special coat and everything. At that moment, Jacob just tears into him completely. Do you really think
such a thing? He snaps at him, didn't he?
He snaps at him. That's the last moment. That's at the very last moment he snaps at him. So he has now lost favor with his father. He obviously has no idea. This is clear. Joseph is clueless about that. What he's doing by telling over these dreams to his brothers what was in fact creating an enormous amount of animosity. Joseph, therefore, the father Jacob says to him, go down to see your, find your brothers. And he says, go down to Shechem. Now, and Jacob, Joseph responds, Hineni, here I am. I'm ready to do it. Now, Hineni is very striking because that word very much is reminiscent of when Abraham is told to do it. He just says, I'm going to do it. And he runs down. What happens when he goes down to Shechem, he's actually told by a man. It seems to be a vestigial passage. He's told by this man to go somewhere else. And his brothers then take him and then seek to kill him. So at this, up until that moment, Joseph has no clue how much he's hated, and he's thrown into the pit. Now, at that moment, he's in a pit. That's a complete paradigm shift for Joseph. And now, what was unknown to him, what he was, one might say, was naive about, but was unknown to him, that is the visceral hatred that his brothers had for him, now was real. They wanted to kill him. Not, what does my dad think? Well, my dad may want to eliminate me too. He realized that, in fact, he realized that I am not the material for the royal nation. In fact, it's strange that he must have asked himself the question, why did my father send me to Shechem? Now, why is this interesting? There's nothing actually in the Torah. Why do we have that thing, goes to Shechem, and the angel told the man, meets him, says, go there. Well, Shechem, as we know, would have been a place you would send someone alone if you were a child of Jacob, if you wanted to get him killed. Why? Because Shechem is exactly the place where people were very angry, because that's where Dina was raped, and that's the place that Jacob feared would in fact come and kill him. So Joseph now is in the pit. And remember, it's the Midianites' travelers are going to take him out. So he has no idea what his father, why didn't his father come down to Egypt to find him, to rescue him all these years? And so what he's thinking in his mind is, in fact, in the past generations, Abraham, in fact, had Isaac and Ishmael, but ultimately Ishmael was sent away and was taken out of the family, was rejected from the family. And we'll see the same with my father, and there was Esav, and Esav was thrown out of the family, and now I have been thrown out of the family.
Let me get this straight. Are you suggesting that in Joseph's mind, it may be that he believes he was set up by his father to go and meet his peril
We're going to see in a moment, this is precisely what he feels. That in fact, what's happening is, we're going to see by the names he gives to his sons, this is exactly what's going through his mind, that his misery is back home, and God is doing things for him in Egypt, so he doesn't feel the pain of the memories. And this goes to the crying, right? We're going to see, why do adults cry? Children cry because they don't really know how to communicate. But when we as adults cry, what does crying really happen? Rav Salvechik of blessed memory discusses that crying for an adult means that feelings of the memories of the past are sort of repressed. And then at a moment they are triggered. We think of pain, of a breakup of family, an old my father, you know, a fight I had with my father. I haven't spoken to my sister in years. And when that residual feeling that has been repressed, those memories come up, it causes intense crying for adults. That's what triggers it. This is what's going to happen. We're going to see that he's going to see not only his children is helping him forget the pain. We're going to see that in a moment. But we're going to see Pharaoh is, in fact, taking the place of his father. If you'll notice that his father, what was the last thing his father did? The last thing his father did was reject his interpretation of his dream, reject his dream and reject the interpretation of his dream. What is Pharaoh going to do? He's going to say, I like your interpretation of the dream.
Very good, true.
I'm embracing you. Not only that, what else will happen? I'm going to give you new clothing. And he does. He gives him royal clothing. What else is he going to do? He's going to name him. That's something a father would do. So Pharaoh is taking him in. And again, in Joseph's mind, he doesn't know. He couldn't possibly have had the information that his coat was brought to Jacob bloodied. He thinks, my father has given up on me because I so what happens is Pharaoh gives him a wife. Well, that's something a dad would do. So on every single level, Pharaoh is sort of coming in now and saying, you can govern, meaning you have that kind of wisdom to lead Mitzrayim, Egypt. My father rejected my ability to be a leader because he said that he got so angry. My father sat me down to Shechem looking for my brothers. Well, why would he send me to such a dangerous place? That would be like sending someone to Jenin, you know, where a Jew. So everything to him is pointing to my, but the pain is there. The pain lingers there. And this is what Joseph is. And he's going to name his children these very odd so let's, names.
Let's talk about those names. Before we get to those, to the names of his sons, it says that Pharaoh called Joseph Zaphnat Paneah. Is that right? Zaphnat Paneah. What does that mean? Do we have an understanding of what that might mean?
Yeah, so Pharaoh saw that Joseph was unique, and here he's assigned a name, by the way, just like Daniel signed a name, that is essentially commensurate with his new position. And so there is a number of explanations of what precisely this means, but the name would be like someone who's able to interpret that was hidden. So Farsh Hatzifunos, that someone who was able to bring to light something that was would otherwise be difficult to see.
Pharaoh also gave him a wife, as you said, Asenat. Apparently means the belonging to the goddess Neith, which is interesting.
And remember that Yosef and Daniel have names that deal directly with the God of Israel. Pharaoh and Nebuchadnezzar are going to assign names that are going to be barren of God's name. Bear in mind something that I pointed out earlier, and that is our sages tell us that Potiphar's wife, who was trying to seduce Joseph, also had an inkling that from her, through Joseph, she would be able to produce, she would be ultimately, through Joseph, she would be able to have a unique family. The mistake what's happening is Joseph is now marrying the daughter of Potiphar's wife, of Potiphar's wife, if you notice here.
Because so the priest of On is believed to be the same as the head of the military guard of Pharaoh. They're believed to be one and the same. Is that correct?
But yeah, look at the name.
Asenath. Okay, so in that case, then this is the daughter of. Right. Okay, this is where we are. Interesting, and so that's that now. By her, he has two sons, and he gives them, as you were pointing out, significant names. Joseph called the name of the firstborn Manasseh, for God has made me forget all my toil and all my father's house. And the name of the second he called Ephraim, for God has caused me to be fruitful in the land of my affliction.
Of my anguish, right. So these two sons are going to be sons who are essentially going to help him cope with the pain of his father's house, the anguish that he has of being rejected. Now he's building a new family, and therefore the pain of the past can now recede. But of course, we're not really successful when we try to forget about family members. Family, after all, is family, and therefore this will not be successful. And we're going to see that through Joseph's tears. We're going to come to that, but Joseph is constantly going to, when he sees his brothers, certainly when he hears all this, he constantly has to run out of the room, and he's crying. He doesn't want to
strain himself. Jason.
I just wanted to jump back to the name. So I had a little look, and Egyptologists have Joseph's new name down as Food Man of the Life or Chief Steward.
Really?
Okay. So the first part is split into two. The Paneah bit is a separate word, so they have him down as Food Man, and then the Paneah thing is of the life, which may mean Nile. And here in Ireland, our main river that runs through is called the Liffey, and that in the Gaelic is life. And in many ancient towns throughout Europe, you'll find that the key, when you go back to the kind of the old language that the people would have spoke, the key river that brought in water to the fields and that allowed trade is nearly always life in its original context. So it's possible he was Food Man of the Nile. Because there are a lot of Egyptian words that pop up in the Hebrew of this Torah portion that have been kind of adopted. So that's worth a study on its own. But that was
interesting.
That.
Mm. So I'm just looking at the study notes on that particular verse, and at least in the New King James Study Bible, it says that the name probably means the God speaks and lives. So there's a few different interpretations of that. But in any case, we seem to be much more certain about the definition, because it has it here in chapter 41, verse 51 and 52 of the names of his sons. And it goes on to say that there was the famine. People began to cry out to Pharaoh. Pharaoh said, "Psh, go and speak to Joseph." And whatever he says, just do that. And so everyone did. Joseph opened all the storehouses and sold to the Egyptians. And so the famine became very severe in the land. So all countries came to Joseph in Egypt to buy grain because the famine was severe in all the lands. Here we are in chapter 42. And it is that Jacob, we're back with Jacob, back at the farm. When Jacob saw that there was grain in Egypt, Jacob said to his sons, "Why do you look at one another?" As if to say, "What are you guys doing? Can you go and get us something to eat? Indeed, I've heard that there is grain in Egypt. Go down to that place and buy for us there that we may live and not die. Go on, you guys. But leave Benjamin here." So here we have the last remaining son, as far as he knows, of Rachel. And there's no way that he's going to let Benjamin out of his sight. He says, "Lest some calamity befall him." And so off they go. And the brothers, it says, Joseph was now governor over all the land, and it was he who sold it to all the people of the land. And Joseph's brothers came and bowed down before him with their faces to the earth. And Joseph saw his brothers and recognized them, but he acted as a stranger to them and spoke roughly to them. And he said to them, "Where do you come from?" And they said, "From the land of Canaan to buy food." So Joseph recognized his brothers, but they did not recognize him. Then Joseph remembered the dreams. And right here, isn't it, Tobia, that this is the first fulfillment of the dreams that he had?
This is unfolding before our eyes. I'd like the listener at all times to bear in mind that what is happening, all these events are unfolding for our eyes, is a prophecy that had to be fulfilled going back to Genesis chapter 15, where God told Abraham that your children will have to go down to Egypt and be a stranger there. And that's what's happening. So there are, on every dimension, everything is happening. Joseph's dreams are now going to unfold before our eyes. Joseph now wants to test his brothers. He doesn't know. He needs a resolution here. He's obviously in an enormous amount of pain, as we discussed, but he needs to know, do they recognize their mistake? That means the question is, why doesn't Joseph just say, "Hi, it's me"? Well, there's a very important reason for this. Joseph needs resolution. He needs to know, did his brothers regret what they had done, A, and B, did when they threw him in the pit, were they simply acting in their best wisdom, or was it done out of hatred and jealousy towards Rachel? Remember, Joseph's mother, Rachel, was the one who was loved, and Leah was, and the question to him, the conundrum, the issue that had to be solved for him is, how would they treat Benjamin? That was very important to Joseph. And if he revealed who he is right now at this stage, "Hi, I'm your brother," he is in charge. They're in Egypt. They're in a lot of trouble. They have to behave in a certain way. So he would lose the opportunity to figure out if his brothers have regretted, and how will they treat Benjamin? Will they cast him aside like me just because he's the child of Rachel? Or will they act differently? That's what's being set up here. So Joseph is very bright. He's setting this up, but he doesn't let them know, because if they catch on, then answer the question, they have to be in a position of free will. He's using an interpreter, but he really doesn't need one, because he wants to overhear the conversation.
No, so he gets to be the fly on the wall, right? He gets to be the fly on the wall, because he can understand the Hebrew, he understands that conversation, he interrogates them, he accuses them of being spies, he finds out all that he can, and then here we are in those verses that you brought up last week, where the brothers say to each other, "We are truly guilty concerning our brother, for we saw the anguish of his soul when he pleaded with us, and we would not hear. Therefore, this distress has come upon us." And Reuben answered them, saying, "Did I not speak to you, saying, do not sin against the boy, and you would not listen? Therefore, behold, his blood is now required of us." But they did not know that Joseph understood them, for he spoke to them through an interpreter, and he turned himself away from them and wept, and he turned to them again and talked with them. And he took Simeon from them and bound them before their eyes. It makes me wonder. It makes me wonder if they drew lots, you know, to choose, or if they just chose the one that was least popular, and it was Simeon.
So you notice when he starts crying is as soon as he now has new information, which he's never had. I mean, remember what we're going to do is what we talked about earlier. Why didn't Joseph write home? Why did he essentially write off his family? We know that this interpretation is correct because of the names he gave his children. That's how we could be sure that, in fact, he's trying to forget it. When he overhears that his brothers are truly his brothers and they regret it and they're in pain and he's a fly on the wall, as you said, there was an interpreter there who's clearly not there now. So these brothers are speaking extemporaneously, unguarded, and are not trying to impress anyone. That's what's very critical here. They're talking among themselves in the presence of Joseph, not knowing who Joseph is, but also believing that Joseph could not understand what they're saying. That means that what's set up here is Joseph is able to listen in, to eavesdrop on their conversation, and to know where their heart really is. And that, when he hears that, notice what happens. Then the crying starts well. Here we're introduced to the crying, because now the whole story, what we know, which we take for granted, Joseph didn't know, now is starting to come at him, and the crying starts to well up. But he's going to continue to test them.
And so he fills their sacks with grain. He put every man's money back in there that they brought down to buy the grain. And sent them on their way, minus Simeon, of course. And, you know, when they were on their way home, they opened up the sacks and they saw the money was there. They freaked out and they said, "What is this that God has done to us?" Because they believe, I suppose, that God is, you know, bringing it back upon them now. And they went and told Jacob, their father, and they told him the whole story and said, "Listen, this guy, he wants us to come back and prove who we are, and we have to bring Benjamin with us." Jason, what's going through your mind?
Just when we get to 34, it's very interesting. They said they've expressed to their father that they have to take Benjamin back, and they are telling Jacob what they're saying that Joseph said to them, and bring your youngest brother into me. And then I shall know that you are not spies, because Joseph's accused them of spying out the nakedness or the defenselessness of the land. So bring your brother to me, your younger brother, and you can prove that you're not spies, because why would a spy take a kiddie along? So they can prove who they were. And it says that then you shall traffic in the land, but that's not what Joseph said. Joseph said, "And then you shall not die," meaning you shan't starve to death in the land. So it's interesting that they I don't know whether they're just trying not to scare their father, and that we kind of messed up and
trying to cushion the blow.
He's going
to
make sure we all die, or whether they're trying to make it sound like, you know, if you let us take him, then we won't just survive, but we'll actually be able to trade.
Right. So they're trying to lighten it a bit. Yeah.
Jason, so that's the perfect point there. They have to convince their father to let Benjamin go, to let Benjamin go down. If they describe the events with the full force of death and so on, Jacob is thinking to himself, "I'm sending my youngest child now to certain death. We have a maniac in Egypt. He's going to kill them." So they're going to, as Jason said, they're going to sort of shave the edges off a little bit in hope that the father might consider it. They certainly, they want to. Water it down. One other point should be said here. All the claims of Joseph is charging them with is completely nonsensical. There's no basis for it. But as Mel Brooks said, it's good to be the king. Meaning, when you're basically the king or second command of Egypt, you could make any kind of charge you want to. You're holding on to all the food. Essentially, why would you think we're spying? Well, that's not going to come up here. We're not spying. But Joseph's charge is clearly nonsensical. It wouldn't make a difference. But they're, like Jason said, they're shaving this down a little bit for the father. It's not going to succeed because...
Even so, I mean, it seems like Jacob's willing to let Sim write him off as good as gone, because you're not having Benjamin is basically the message. And then Reuben, now this is what you were referring to earlier on, Tobia. Reuben spoke to his father saying, "Kill my two sons." I mean, can you imagine his two sons going, "What the? Kill my two sons. If I do not bring him back to you, put him in my hands and I will bring him back to you." But he said, "My son shall not go down with you, for his brother is dead and he is left alone. Now, what does it mean he is left alone? He's left. Does it just mean that he is the last? And he's what's left what, over of Rachel.
Yeah. And now, what comes into view here is a lot, is so much about Reuben, and that is that he means well, but his judgment is off. And this will find us over again. He's going, like, what do you mean kill my children? Jacob is going, are you insane? Why would I kill my grandchildren? That's to me like my children. What's going to happen is that if we notice that Reuben is going to fail, the person who will emerge as the leader of the family is not going to be the person who's going to say, kill my two children. Mm. This will come up in a moment, but it's important here is Jacob is going to ultimately trust Yehuda, because Yehuda had, in fact, at this stage, has already experienced the loss of two children. So, and it's very important to juxtapose this. Reuben is saying, kill my two children, but Judah ultimately, remember his son Aaron Onan have died. Judah knows what it's like to bury two children. So he's able to make the case at the right juncture, at the exact moment to say, look, Dad, I know what it's like to lose children. I've lost two. So juxtapose Reuben's, again, Reuben means well, his timing is off, and the reason he's trying to explain his father why he should try, it doesn't even make sense. He's obviously not the kind of material for the leadership. He's going to lose that. Yehuda, everything is going to be juxtaposed one against the other. So we're going to see that coming into view very, very shortly.
So a terrifying 30 seconds for Reuben's two sons, but fortunately Jacob rejects that offer. And as they begin to, the supplies get low again, Jacob says, you guys better get back down to Egypt and get some more. And they say, well, we can't do that because that guy's still there. Simeon's there. He said we've got to take Benjamin. And it is Judah who says, I myself will be surety for him. From my hand you shall require him. If I do not bring him back to you and set him before you, then let me bear the blame forever, he says. And so eventually Jacob gives in and lets them go. And he says, look, take some, they've got some balm, some honey, spices, myrrh, pistachio nuts, and almonds. Nice.
Foods that are indigenous to the land of Israel, which aren't identified at all with Egypt. So therefore, this is like bringing him stuff that Egypt doesn't have. It could be the wealthiest country right now, but these are just unique foods.
These are some exotic foods as far as Pharaoh is concerned.
Right. This is very exotic for Egypt, right?
Okay, so he's really going all out to placate this harsh chap and to secure that all of his sons will come back safely and with food. And so off they go. And so the men arrive, they're there with Benjamin, and Joseph saw Benjamin with them and said to the steward of the house, take these men back to my home, slaughter an animal, make ready for these men, will dine with me at noon. And then the man did as Joseph ordered, and the man brought the men to the house of Joseph. Now, these guys are freaking out. They're thinking, oh, you know, he's going to enslave us and our donkeys, as they say. Mm. And they're really quite concerned, and understandably so. And so they seek to explain themselves in detail. They say, oh, sir, we indeed came down the first time to buy food, but it happened when we came back to our encampment that we opened our sacks, and there each man's money was in the mouth of his sack and our money in the full. And they explain it all. And he says, you know, peace be with you. Do not be afraid. Your God and the God of your father has given you treasure in your sacks. I had your money. And then he brought Simeon out to them. So they're all reunited. So the man brought the men into Joseph's house and gave them water, and they washed their feet. He gave their donkeys feed, and they made ready to eat. And when Joseph came home, they brought him the present which was in their hand in the house. They bowed down before him. There's another very blatant fulfillment of the dreams which he had. And he asked them about their well-being. Is your father well? The old man of whom you spoke, is he still alive? He asks. Mm. And they answered, and your servant, our father is in good health. He is alive. And they bowed their heads down and prostrated themselves again. And then he lifted his eyes and saw his brother Benjamin, his mother's son is what it says. And he said, is this your younger brother of whom you spoke to me? And he said, God be gracious to you, my son. Now his heart, and this is what it says, his heart yearned for his brother. And so Joseph made haste and sought somewhere to weep. And he went into his chamber and wept there. Then he washed his face and came out and restrained himself and said, serve the bread. Tobiah.
Yeah. What now what's happening is he's going to test them. This is critical. This tremendous resolution. You see how once we understand what was going on in Joseph's mind until this point, and now he's going to test them, see if they're going to stand up and are they going to defend Benjamin. He's he's going to in fact get them completely intoxicated, not for any really for a very simple reason. That is that our sages tell us that the way you know someone is how they behave when they're drunk.
Get I remember them to speak freely. Yeah.
Yes, Mel Gibson a number of years ago, an actor,
theologian Mel Gibson,
the luminary, the great. Our gift. What would we do without Mel Gibson? I know the Irish are very proud of him, but so you know, but Mel Gibson had a few drinks, so he let it all out. You know, the Jews are responsible for the wars and so on. What Joseph is doing here, he's plying the alcohol to get them to speak freely, and they wanted to demonstrate that they had nothing to fear. If you had this secret and you didn't want to be honest, you'd keep the alcohol away from your lips because it would be very hard to be guarded at this moment. So everything now, the stage is set for Joseph to be sure that, in fact, that his entire view of what had occurred. Remember now, see, this is coming full circle. In the pit, everything comes to Joseph in a totally different worldview. Oh, my gosh, my brothers wanted to kill me. My father wanted to dispose of me. That's why he sent me to Shechem. They want nothing to do with me, which means what's happened to me is what happened to Yishmael, what's happened to Esav, and now it's happening to me. Now he has to rethink everything, but he wants to be sure. So he's going to feed them, dine them, and wine them, and see how they're going to deal. This is the big test. How will they deal with my mother's son? Will they risk their lives for it? And that's what's happening right before our eyes now.
So I imagine, Jason, that the streets of Ireland are full of people that are very, very frank in their speech. But what's on your mind?
You know, it's... we do have a lot of pubs. There's probably a pub on every street. But they're full, so the streets are empty, so that's good. what I really love is in the passage we've just read, in 29 in particular, is that it seems that the brothers are trying, at least, to protect Benjamin in this. And I get that because that they all come in and Joseph doesn't see Benjamin. But when they bow down, then he sees Benjamin. So I'm assuming that Benjamin's at the back. He's not as tall as his brothers. And so they're sheltering him. And I think that's a really beautiful picture that when they bow down, then Joseph gets to see Benjamin hidden behind. And
that's a really good point.
For me, that gives, you know, a little, it adds some credence to that they've learned their lesson. They do not want Benjamin to go the way of Joseph. And it's kind of sweet that they're looking after him a little bit better in this passage.
Yeah. So now that reminds me, they've given so much to eat, huge portions, and yet it says that Joseph made sure that Benjamin had five times the portion that the other guys had. And I wonder, Tobia, if he was doing so to see if they would treat him the way that
jealousy,
to see if that would happen.
Right.
Yeah.
That means he's doing for Benjamin what his father... I mean, looking back, he had to blame his father in some way for showing him so much. I mean, he had to figure out, why did my brother want to kill me? Well, my father was showing me all his favor. So he's now setting up the test perfectly, the same exact conditions. Benjamin now is lavish with gifts of the other brother. Will they in fact behave the way they did before, which would indicate to Joseph that what they had done originally was out of pure jealousy or was just misguided. In fact, Joseph was naive by telling the dream and so on. That's what he wants to make sense of. So he's going to do for Benjamin. He's going to keep Benjamin right next to him, give him all this much more, and to see if this will affect their judgment. Of course, things are going to – he's going to see a moment in the moment that, in fact, they're seeing that they regretted it. They're going to see that they're going to stick their neck out to protect Benjamin.
Yeah. Now, well, this is what happens. So he sends them again on their way. All of them, they're gone. But he plants within Benjamin's sack a silver goblet, I think.
Yeah.
That he says he uses to practice divination. He sends people, his servants, after them to catch them and say, "Look, you know, it's missing. You guys have probably got it." They say, "Look, take the life of the one who has it. We certainly didn't do it. And when they opened up the sacks, lo and behold, it's in Benjamin's sack. And they tore their clothes, and each man loaded his donkey and returned to the city. So Judah and his brothers came to Pharaoh's house, and he was still there. And they fell before him on the ground. And Joseph said to them, "What deed is this that you have done? Did you not know that such a man as I can certainly practice divination?" And then Judah said, what shall we say to my lord? What shall we speak, or how shall we clear ourselves? God has found out the iniquity of your servants. Here we are, my lord's slaves, both we and he also, with whom the cup is found. But he said to him, "Far be it from me that I should do so. The man in whose hand the cup was found, he shall be my slave. And as for you, go in peace to your father." Oh, my goodness. So Judah, it's reminiscent of... When Reuben goes to get him out of the pit, and he's not there, and he says to the brothers, he's gone, and me, where will I go? Where can I possibly go to find him? I mean, what am I going to do? But it seems like this is what's going through Judah's mind right now, because he absolutely assured his father that he would bring the lad back. Tobia.
Yeah, so what we have here is, who is going to emerge? And that's where we're coming to in the next portion. Who is going to emerge as the leader of the family? Mm-hmm. So there's going to be resolution. There's also going to be the tying into Hanukkah, and that is, how do you in fact inspire another person by throwing them in a pit? I remember years and years ago, there was a Jews for Jesus missionary place in South Africa, and I think a whole bunch of people just sort of burnt the place down. Is that how you deal with people who you want to, or do you bring the light of Hanukkah? Do you inspire people in that way? Yehuda is going to know at every juncture the correct move, the right thing to do, how to be. He's not perfect, as we have seen, but he is the person who has those qualities that would, he'd ultimately be the father of King David and the Mashiach himself, which would all come together in the future. So again, this chapter is once again Maaseh Avos, which means the events of our fathers, is Siman L'Banim, is a signpost up ahead for the children. Mm. And that's what we're observing right now.
That is our Torah portion. Jason, any parting thoughts, my friend?
Well, if this is the first time going through this Torah portion, listeners, you are left on a cliffhanger. Leaves you right there. I'm also reminded as well of the kind of the big picture and the little picture. So when we're going through this, we see all this stuff happening to Joseph and his brothers, but this is like this is the whole history of the Jewish people here. It's like a huge thing. Had they not made it to Egypt to get that grain, where would that have left Israel today? That blows my mind. That one trip where they go down to get food from Pharaoh
makes all the difference.
Yeah, defined everything. So just remember, when you make the smallest of choices, it can have huge consequences.
That's so true. Next week, we are in Vayigash. That is Genesis chapter 44, verse 18 to 47, 27. Thank you, Jason of spiritualbabies.net, Tovia Singer of outreachjudaism.org, where you can get a copy of Let's Get Biblical, Why Doesn't Judaism Accept the Christian Messiah, volumes 1 and 2. Well worth getting. I highly recommend it. And until next week, dear listeners, be blessed and be set apart by the truth of our Father's word. Shalom.